Hello and welcome to the Green Room Golf Course podcast from the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association. Thanks for listening to this podcast, which sheds a light upon the golf industry and what it takes to maintain a modern course. I hope you enjoy the show.
Hi everybody, I'm Sammy Strutt, Head of Member Development for Bigger, and I'd like to welcome you to this Continue to Learn Extra webinar. I'm pleased to welcome Dr. Colin Mumford, Technical Support Manager for Bayer. Today, Colin will be talking about how you can use entomopathogenic nematodes to control turf pests the natural way. He will be discussing how to store and handle them, how to identify the optimum time to apply them, and how to optimise their application. Colin has a background in golf course management, as well as a wide-ranging experience and qualifications in the amenity and sports turf sector. His role as technical support manager at Bayer is largely focused on advising industry professionals with general management, best practice, and technical advice. Colin also oversees new product trials for the UK and Ireland. With that, I will hand over to you, Colin.
Right. Thank you, Sammy. And thank you, everyone, for attending today. As Sammy said, I'm going to be talking about entomopathogenic nematodes. If you see my head moving, it's because my screen is in this direction and the camera is in this direction. So I'm not being distracted by anyone in the background. It's just looking at my screen. So the things that, as Sammy said, I'll be talking about today, what are entomopathogenic nematodes? I'll give you an example of other industries where they're used as well and what pests they control. And then I want to talk about how they work, the life cycle of the nematodes. And understanding that is sort of key to the success of using them against turf pests. And then I'll talk about the sort of the nuts and bolts of it, you know, how to store them, how to get the correct timing of the application, and some tips on how to apply them. So entomopathogenic nematodes, I shan't be saying that word too often today. What are they? Well, firstly, I think we should distinguish the different types of nematodes that we encounter in sports turf management. There are good ones and there are bad ones. Entomopathogenic nematodes, they're the good ones. They control pests of turf. The bad ones are the plant parasitic nematodes. These are the ones that will feed on the root system of your turf and cause the root system to deform, stress out the grass plant, and ultimately make your turf look quite ill. So, entomopathogenic nematodes, I'm just going to refer to them as nematodes from now on. What are they? Well, if you had a microscope or a powerful magnifying glass and you had a look at them underneath there, this is what you would see. Essentially, they're a worm. They're half a millimeter to 0.9 millimeters long, or 500 to 900 micrometers, if you prefer. The important thing to understand about the nematodes is that they all have four larval stages, and they go through these four stages, and at the end of each larval stage a new cuticle is produced and the old one is molted off. Now it's the third larval stage that we're really interested in, because they will produce an alternative third larval stage. This has evolved and it's a specialized sort of survival and dispersal stage. And this is referred to as a dower larva, a dower juvenile. Put it up on the screen, that's easier. Its occurrence is dependent on certain environmental conditions, and producers of nematodes are able to mimic these conditions so that they produce this third larval stage, this dower juvenile. Now, the dower juvenile, it can withstand adverse, and it doesn't feed. It has good fat reserves, so it's better able to survive in extreme conditions. And this is why, when you buy a nematode product, it will be a dower juvenile that you're applying. You can also see on the screen there that they react to CO2. And basically, this is one of the methods that they use to find a host target, you know, a pest to reside in. And because they're better able to withstand the, you know, harsher environments, they can survive in all soil environments. And one thing that I would like to add is that these nematodes, they're not harmful to humans or plants or other vertebrates. Now, just as a quick where they're used, you can see that they're used here in nurseries, so ornamental horticulture for various pests such as the vine weevil. Excuse me while I let my dog out. Sorry about that, she just keeps scratching at the door. So the other industries are turf, as we know, and then greenhouses for food production. And here are some examples of crops that they're applied to control pests of those crops. So mushrooms, soft fruits, top fruits, citrus, corn, and palm trees. And there's a whole array of different insect pests there on the screen as well. Now, in terms of typical UK pests, you can see here we have quite an extensive list. This isn't like a comprehensive list, but it gives you a good example of the various pests that are controlled in the UK. But you'll see that leather jackets are on that list, as well as chafer grubs. And these are both real problems of turf, you know, where they feed on the root system, sever the root system, and the plant, the grass plant, can't take up water or nutrients. But you'll also see that in warmer climates, the nematodes are deployed, particularly on golf courses. So mole crickets in warmer climates are a real issue, and nematodes are one way to control them. But in general, though, all insect larvae in the soil will be controlled by nematodes. So they're not specific to one particular pest. They are really a broad spectrum pest control option. Now, for today's talk, I'm just going to refer to the chafer grub. That's my pest of choice today. And I've used this because we're coming into chafer grub season now. You know, the beetle is known as the May bug. We're in May, and typically they will start to come out of the ground and become a problem. The adults, you know, laying their eggs. The top two images in this slide, you can see are showing the damage that the chafer grubs themselves cause. As I mentioned, they sever the root system, the grass plant can't take up water and nutrients, and as a result, when we have dry conditions, the grass will have drought symptoms and, you know, can potentially die back. But also, because to the soil, because it doesn't have a root system anchoring it to the soil, the turf can easily be peeled back. And if you can peel back the turf easily, then so can the birds and mammals that feed on grubs. So in the bottom images, you can see damage caused by birds on the right and damage caused by mammals, most likely badgers, on the left-hand side. So how do nematodes work? How can we prevent this from happening with nematodes? Well, to understand how they work, we really need to look at their life cycle. And we'll start from the point of we've introduced nematodes. The nematodes firstly need to locate a host. They need that host to complete their life cycle. Sorry about that. The dog wanted to come in again. So they search for they seek out and they locate a host. Once they've located a host, and I mentioned they'll use CO2 emissions from they hone in on them following the CO2 trail that the pests give off. But once they've located a grub, in this case, they need to they need to attach to it and actually penetrate into it. So they will typically use the natural openings that are available in the grub, so that the mouth and the anus. But for some other insects, the larvae and grubs, they have what's called spiracles. And spiracles are essentially a breathing hole that's down the side of the insect, or the larvae or the grub. Now, once the nematodes have got into the host pest, the nematodes actually have a bacteria in them. It's a symbiotic bacteria, so it's a sort of mutually beneficial relationship between the bacteria and the nematode. The nematode acts as the transport mechanism for the bacteria, so it gets it from A to B, and the bacteria will actually sort of, when it's released, will create the conditions that the nematode needs to complete its life cycle. So the nematodes will release that bacteria. It's the bacteria actually that will paralyze the grub and cause it to die. It's not the nematodes that actually kill the grub, it's the bacteria that they release that kills the grub. But in releasing that grub, as I say, it creates the conditions for the nematode to complete its life cycle, and it provides a food source for the nematode as well. So the nematode, it will go from that third larval stage to the fourth larval stage, become an adult, and then it will multiply and produce offspring. Now the when the nematodes inside that grub have exhausted all the resources, they've eaten everything that's possible to eat, they will vacate the dead body, the cadaver. They'll exit and they'll go and search for a new host to complete their life cycle. You know, the offspring will go and find a new host to complete their life cycle. And so it carries on in a loop. They'll locate the host, get inside it, release bacteria, multiply, and then exit the host. Now, in terms of that's the life cycle for sort of all nematodes, the way in which they actually locate the host varies from species to species. And so I have a few examples here of how they actually locate the host. We call this first one a hunter, and I'm going to attempt to pronounce its name. It's Heterohabditis bacteriophora, or something like that. You can see it's on the screen there. These are a sort of a seek and destroy nematode, if you like. They will actively seek out, hunt down the prey, attach themselves to it, penetrate, and complete their life cycle. Then we have a different activity. This is one we refer to as a resident, the resident. This is Steinonema carpocapsae, a bit easier to pronounce. And what this does, it doesn't go looking for the host species. It will sit and wait for something to come along. And when it does come along, it will jump on it, ambush it, attach itself to it, penetrate, and complete its life cycle. Example I've got here, which we've termed the explorer. This is Steinonema feltiae. These are more tolerant of colder conditions, so as low as 10 degrees centigrade. And their strategy for getting hold of a pest is sort of a halfway between that of the hunter and the resident. So it will go out seeking the pest, but then it will stand back, wait for one to come along, and then jump on it, ambush it, and attach itself, and then complete its life cycle. Now, in terms of getting the most out of nematodes, ideally the more types of activity you have, the better. So rather than just have one species, you know, ideally you'd have more. So three, if you had all three of these species, that would be ideal. You get greater effectiveness from them is that each species wants to become the dominant species. And to become the dominant species, it needs to multiply. And to multiply, it needs to find a target host to complete its life cycle to produce offspring. And because each species wants to become the dominant species, they try to outcompete each other. So effectively, they become that bit more aggressive and more voracious in their attempts to get hold of host species to multiply, complete their life cycle, and become that dominant species. So three different activities, three different species is preferable. That's a bit about the nematodes and their life cycle. Now I really want to talk about the nuts and bolts, so how best to store them and apply them and so on. So storage, what are the right conditions for storing nematodes? Fresh is best, I think, is the motto we should use here. Really, you should be using your nematodes as soon as you take delivery of them, if the ground weather conditions allow. If the ground weather conditions don't allow, it could be too windy to spray, the ground could be too dry, it could be too sunny. As I say, you don't want to expose them to bright sunlight, because UV light will kill them. If the ground conditions aren't correct and you need to store them, there's a couple of things that you need to bear in mind. They'll come in a container, a box of some sort, various nematode products come in different containers, but essentially they'll come in a box. What you don't want to do when you take delivery of it is open that box outside your sheds in bright sunlight, because the sunlight will actually, the UV light will kill the nematodes, or certainly will drastically reduce their lifespan. So don't expose them to direct sunlight. If you do need to store them, don't expose them to extremes of temperature. Don't freeze them. Don't expose them to temperatures above 30 degrees centigrade, because again, this will significantly reduce their lifespan. So ideally, you want to put them in a fridge if you need to store them for any time. So take them out of the container that they came in, the box they came in. Put them in the fridge. Don't just stack them in a corner. You ideally want to sort of loosely store them. If you stack them, potentially you could end up getting crushing injuries. They'll start to consolidate, and it's not conducive to the health of the nematodes. So ideally, just loosely store them in a fridge. And the fridge needs to be at a temperature between 4 and 8 degrees. It can be as high as 10 degrees, but I tend to err on the side of caution and say that 4 to 8 degrees would be the optimum range to store the nematodes in the fridge. Now, nematodes will typically have a 6-week shelf life from the date of production at the producers. By the time that you receive them, it could be several days after they were produced. So you should have a minimum of a 5-week shelf life with your nematodes. That should be plenty of time with which to actually deploy them out on the golf course. And we have seen that the nematodes will last longer than their sort of given shelf life. But really, to ensure that you're getting the maximum out of them, you should use them before the expiry date. And there will be an expiry date on the pack. So make sure you store them correctly and make sure you use them before the end of that expiry date. Now, this next slide really is inspired by Monty Python and the dead parrot sketch. It's not dead, it's resting. And that's really what can happen with nematodes. So if you're of a mind to take a sample of the nematodes out of a pack and put them in a solution, stick them under a microscope to see what the health of the nematodes are, you should see this. They should be all curvy, moving, wiggling. That's a live nematode. Dead nematodes are really easy to spot because they're dead straight. Pardon the pun, but they're like matchsticks. They're dead straight, and they'll have some gas bubbles forming inside them, which is that bacteria starting to ferment away. We come on to the next one, which is resting nematodes, and they can be quite difficult to identify, or can be easy to mistake for dead nematodes. But there is one way to identify them. So if you look here where the arrow is pointing, you'll see that it's a straight nematode, which you'd think is a dead one, but it's bent at one end, either at the head or the tail. And that is an indication that it's resting. So it's not dead, it's resting. So that's just one distinction I think it's important to know if you are to take a sample, look at it under a microscope or a magnifying glass. Don't jump to the conclusion, this is dead. If it's got that bent end on the tail or the head, it means it's resting. It's not actually dead. So we come on to the timing of the application. And really, it's important that the application coincides with egg hatch. Nematodes, they won't control eggs. It's the offspring from those eggs, the newly hatched, the juvenile grubs or juvenile larvae that you want to control. So for Schaefer grubs, and it's the first or second instar stage of growth that's most susceptible to the nematodes. And this was the case for insecticides. So a few years ago, we had Merit Turf that would only control the first and the second instar stage of growth. And conversely, insecticides that have been available the last couple of years with an emergency approval, they only control first and second instar stage of growth. So we want to our application to coincide with the egg hatch. How do we know that when eggs are being hatched? And that really comes down to monitoring the activity of the adult beetle, a Schaefer beetle, or in the case of leather jackets, monitoring the activity of the crane fly, the adult crane fly. Now, as a general guide, the Schaefer beetle species are active from mid-May to late June in a typical year. This might not be the case every year. So last year, they were a good 6 weeks, or the last couple of years, they were a good 6 weeks late coming out of the ground. So they were more into the July period. Conversely, with crane flies, the one that we typically get on turf is the European crane fly. And in a typical year, the crane flies are active between late August and early October. But last year, they really didn't start turning up until October. So again, they were quite late. So environmental conditions do have an influence on the timing of them emerging as adults. And when they're emerged as adults, they will be actively laying eggs in your turf, in the soil under your turf. One other crane fly that we can get on our turf is, although it's called the common crane fly, it's not the common one that we get on turf. The European crane fly is the crane fly that we get in abundance on turf. But the common crane fly is quite different. That will have can produce several generations throughout the year. So if you see a crane fly in springtime or in the summer, that is most likely going to be a common crane fly. Now, I've said you want to monitor the adult activity. The best way to monitor it is to use something like a pheromone trap. You would need to check the pheromone traps on a regular basis. But if you put the pheromone traps, dot them around your facilities, Schaefer beetles, there's specific pheromones for beetles and for crane fly. So get the appropriate one. The Schaefer beetles, they'll go into the trap. You'll come along, you'll see a couple of Schaefer beetles in there. You can empty the trap, dispatch the beetles, and then put the trap back, and then keep checking it. And what you'll see over time is you'll get more and more beetles going into that trap. And then eventually you'll see a decline in the number of beetles that will be, or crane fly, that will be coming into that trap. And that's the key to knowing when to apply nematodes. You want to be applying the nematodes 3 to 4 weeks after the peak of activity. So similar to the current situation with COVID-19 and the government talk about the peak of the curve and we're over the peak of the curve, you're looking for that decline in activity of the adults in the pheromone traps. And then when you see that decline, 3 to 4 weeks is when you should be, later is when you should be applying them. Now, the reason why it's 3 to 4 weeks is that all the time that the adults have been active, they've been laying eggs. The eggs take 2 weeks to hatch. But because all eggs aren't laid at the same time, and therefore they don't all hatch out at the same time, if you allow 3 to 4 weeks before you apply the nematodes, the vast majority of all those eggs would have hatched out, and you will then be able to have grubs there or larvae there that the nematodes can immediately target and complete their life cycles in. And then for the remainder, the offspring from those nematodes should go to other newly hatched larvae or grubs. Now, in terms of how to apply the grubs, before you do any applications, you want to make sure that you've got the ground conditions as best as possible to accommodate the nematodes. So if you've got lots of thatch in your turf, you want to try and do everything you can to minimize the thatch, because you want the nematodes where the roots are. And if you've got any sort of substantial thatch, the nematodes can get held up in that thatch layer and not get down to the roots where the actual pests are. So anything you can do to reduce thatch will help. Similarly, if you can avoid using granular fertilizers prior to and after you've applied the nematodes, just initially, because they can effectively, you can get some scorching from the fertilizer, which is damaging. So, it's not necessarily the case for all granular fertilizers, but as a general rule, if you can avoid using a granular fertilizer a couple of weeks before and a couple of weeks after the application, that will have less impact on the actual nematodes. Ideally, you want to puncture the surface as well, so this just aids the nematodes to get into the surface. So using something like a sorrel roller or micro or needle tines prior to an application just helps get them into the surface. And whatever you do, don't apply nematodes to dry soil. Nematodes are very sensitive. They need moisture to maintain them themselves. If it's too dry, the nematodes will just desiccate and they become unviable. They die. So if you irrigate the day before you intend to apply, that will ensure there's adequate moisture in the ground for the nematodes. And then a couple more points. Root zone temperature. You want to apply the nematodes when you've had soil temperatures of 12 degrees or more for at least several hours a day. They need that temperature just to keep them more active. And as I've said already, avoid applying nematodes in direct sunlight. So the best time to apply them is first thing in the morning with low light intensity, or in the evening when there's low light intensity, or if it's an overcast day, it's not a bright sunny day. In terms of your sprayer, the nematodes can withstand a pressure of up to 20 bar, but ideally you want to keep your pressure below 5 bar. It just makes it more comfortable for the nematodes when they're being forced through a nozzle. And also from your sprayer's point of view, you don't want the pump doing overtime to try and crank up a high amount of pressure. So if you can keep it below 5 bar, that would be ideal. Remove all the filters though, because nematodes will get caught up in filters. If they don't get clogged in the filters, you'll just be applying straight water because they're held back by the filters. Generally, they will get clogged and cause a disruption in the flow. So remove all the filters. If you're using a knapsack sprayer, remove the filter in the hand lance as well, and that will avoid any issues. I've got here also about avoid having the heating of the tank. So if you are thinking of applying of an evening, but you think, right, just to speed up the process, I'll fill the tank with water now, and I'll, you know, it's left parked outside during the day. If it's going to warm up the tank, warm up the water, and that wouldn't be ideal. You want to use cool water to get the most out of those nematodes when applying them, or to be the least harmful to the nematodes. A couple of other general rules when applying the nematodes. If you have a tank with a small tank capacity, or if it is an APSEC sprayer, you want to pre-mix the nematodes in a bucket into like an emulsion and then pour it into the tank. But always, if possible, if you've got agitation, keep the agitation going so that they're kept a nice uniform distribution within the solution. Now, I mentioned the size of the Dower juveniles earlier, and I've got it on here again. And this is just to reiterate that you want large droplets. So use nozzles that will produce a coarse droplet spray pattern, because you need big drops to carry the nematodes. And because you want the nematodes in the soil, you don't want them on the turf, big drops have the added benefit that they're going to bounce and roll off the leaves and the turf canopy and ultimately end up on the surface of the soil, where they can then wash into the root zone. One other consideration, and this relates to irrigation after applications as well, don't apply them if heavy rainfall is forecast, because if you're on a constructed profile, so a sand dominant root zone that's free draining, or if you're on a push-up green, an old, you know, natural soil green that's got a good soil structure and it is still free draining, if you apply the nematodes and it starts to rain heavily, they can actually be washed through the root zone and go down the drain. You know, the nematodes need to get to their host and get in their host before any large soil, otherwise they can get washed through the system. And so the same applies to irrigation. Once you've applied them, the nematodes, if you give a very light irrigation, just to, if there are any left on the leaf surface, which they shouldn't be if you had these large droplets going down, but if there are, light irrigation will just wash them into the root zone of the soil. But don't over irrigate, because if you over irrigate, you can flush them through the root zone, or if you don't flush them through the root zone, you can actually drown them. Nematodes need air as much as they need water, so be mindful that you want to keep the soil moist, but don't irrigate to the point where you're getting drainage to occur, or where you're saturating the turf. Now, I've just got the last two slides. I realise we're getting a bit tight for time now. I just wanted to talk about the dead bodies, the cadavers. Some people, when they've applied nematodes, they like to dig up a bit of the turf to see how effective the nematodes have been, and then they can't find any dead bodies that, you know, and so they think, oh, it hasn't worked. Well, this is hopefully will explain why that is. So first and foremost, the cadavers will be different colors. You get red ones and gray ones, dependent on which species of nematode actually got into them and the bacteria that they released. So you'll clearly see red ones and gray ones. But as I say, you need to do that quite quickly, because the cadavers, the dead bodies, they decay really quickly, because ultimately they're just an empty shell, because all the innards have been eaten out by the nematodes. And if you do find them, they might not have any deployed to move on to the next target host. And perhaps this image will explain it in greater detail. So this is my last slide. You can see here, if I wave my mouse around, there's numbers 1 to 10, and these are indicating the cadavers. So you can see number 4, you can barely see it. Number 5, you can barely see that one. Same for 3 and 2. You can see 6 a bit easier, but 7, 8, and 9, and 10 you can see quite clearly, because these were probably infected with the nematodes at a later date, so it's taken that bit longer. Or it could be due to the species of Schaefer grub. you don't typically just get one type of schaefer grub in your soil. So if you had a small Welsh schaefer or a big fat juicy cock schaefer, you know, there's a big difference in size, and that could also explain why you can see one and not the other. But you can see here, this white dot is a grub that survived, and this white dot here is a grub that survived, you know, ones that haven't been infected. So if you pulled back the turf and you saw some living grubs and you couldn't see any dead ones, you'd be thinking, well, that didn't work. But the case is they have worked. It's just that those cadavers, they will break down, rot down very quickly. This image on the top right hand here, you can see as an example of a grub that's turned red from the nematode species that is difficult to pronounce there, so I shan't attempt it. But you can see on this lower image, hopefully you can see that on your screens, this is a cadaver that actually has nematodes in it, and it has turned red as well. So that was a quick whistle-stop tour of some basic tips on nematodes. And so I've quickly explained what the nematodes are, whether we've got good ones, entomopathogenic nematodes, we've got bad nematodes, the plant parasitic nematodes. And everything I've talked about today is applying the good ones, the entomopathogenic nematodes. I briefly mentioned other industries where they use their horticulture and food production, and gave some examples of pests that they control. But in general, any insect larvae in the soil, they will control. I've also explained briefly about how they work, so that the life cycle of the nematodes, that they release this symbiotic bacteria, which is the bacteria that kills the grub, not the nematode itself. It just creates the conditions for the nematode to complete its life cycle. And then finally, I've talked about how to store them. So in a fridge, 4 to 8 degrees, don't expose them to direct sunlight. Ideally use them as soon as you can. And with your timing of applications, use pheromone traps to monitor the activity of the adults, and apply 3 to 4 weeks after you've seen that peak of activity. And then finally, how to apply them. As I say, take all the filters out of your sprayer. If you've got a small capacity sprayer, pre-mix them. Also, ensure that your ground conditions are right. You haven't got dry soil before you apply them. You've minimized the amount of thatch that's present, puncturing the surface as well to help them get into the surface. So, thank you very much for listening. That, as I say, that was a brief overview of entomopathogenic nematodes and how to store and apply them. If you have any questions, or if you think of some, we'll have a question and answer session now, but if you think of any questions at a later date, my contact details are there on the screen, colin.mumford@bayer.com. So please feel free to email them to me. Also, we have more information on our website, so that is there. I have one final screen for you. This is the code for your CPD points. So I shall put that up now and then hand back to Sammy.
Many thanks, Colin. I've learned some things that I never thought I would need to learn today, I have to say. We've got some questions coming in. So from our viewers. So I shall start ticking through them. Obviously, if I repeat myself not having much technical knowledge, then you can correct me. So first question, how far will the EPNs move from the application area, i.e. migrate to areas other than sprayed?
Yeah, certainly. So they don't move a fantastic amount. Having said that, I've seen trials with the with three species, and because they're more competitive, more aggressive, they seek out more, and they will move up to 6 inches in the soil, both horizontally and vertically. Now, 6 inches doesn't sound very far, but when you're half a millimeter or 0.9 of a millimeter, 6 inches is a phenomenal distance to essentially go potholing, because that's what a nematode needs to do to get through the soil. It's potholing, basically. So up to 6 inches, it would be the maximum.
Okay. Will the pH water levels impact the nematodes when spraying?
It can do. But only if you've got extremes of pH. So if you've got really acidic or really alkaline. So, ideally you want your pH, the ideal would be neutral, but somewhere, around just above 7, just below 7 would be fine.
Okay. Is there a pre-application and post-application VMC range to aim for on surfaces?
Yes. So you don't want to saturate the surface. So VMC, volumetric moisture content. So we're talking in percentages, really. And around 25% volumetric moisture content would be ideal. So of the soil, you've got your pores, drainage pores and capillary pores for retaining moisture. And of those pores, 25% volumetric moisture content would be suitable.
Okay. I'm glad you explained what VMC is because I had no idea. Can an application of nematodes be done in conjunction when applying compost teas? Or would it be feasible to culture these nematodes in a compost brew?
So nematodes are compatible with many, many things. We're in the process of producing a document that shows all the things that they're compatible with. Fungicides, not all, but certain species are more compatible than others with certain things. But they can be compatible with fungicides, herbicides, compost teas, certainly. So we're actually compiling a list of those, and that will be on our website hopefully in the next couple of weeks. But yes, is the answer. I suppose really you should seek advice from any supplier who is selling you something that you're intending to mix with the nematodes. Ultimately they're very robust, because I say that the nematodes that you're applying are this third larval stage, this the dour juvenile, and they're very able to withstand quite inhospitable environments, which other things in a mix could create. So yes is the answer.
Okay. Great. Will one application of all three species survive a full season with the correct soil environment? If we had a period of heavy rain, would you need another application for the pest later in the season?
Really, the need for a second application depends on how serious the problem is on your facility. When you apply the nematodes, they'll go through that cycle, produce offspring, and those offspring will go to other host pests within the soil profile. But it's not a process that is ongoing. You don't just apply once and then it's going to carry on until everything is completely eradicated from your soil. Because those it depends on the conditions in your soil. We look to produce the conditions that are beneficial to the nematodes, so maintain good health in the nematodes. And so by doing that, when they produce their offspring, that larval stage isn't going to go to become a dour juvenile. It's going to be a regular third larval stage. And so that's why you don't really get that ongoing sort of chain of events to occur. It will happen for one or two generations, but it would tail off. So a long-winded answer where regards high infestations are required, whether a second application is required. And there are two strategies. One strategy is to apply a sort of a half rate of nematodes and then wait for 2 weeks and then apply the other half of the nematodes, so that you're spreading your bet, as it were. You're getting those hatched eggs now applying them at a later date to get secondary eggs that have hatched. But what's really important is how many nematodes you're applying, really. So there are various nematode products available. They all typically have the same application rate, and that is, I can only speak from my own experience of Bayer's nematode product, because I've sort of been involved with that. But so for that, it's comes in at a 500 million nematode pack size, and that 500 million nematodes will treat an area 1,000 meters squared. That equates to 500,000 nematodes per square meter. So you are putting an extremely high number of nematodes down. And a worst case scenario for Schaefer grub infestation would be about 1,000 grubs per meter squared. You know, that would be a horrendous infestation. So if assuming all the nematodes you've applied, those 500,000, if they all found a target host and you had a uniform distribution, that would equate to 500 nematodes per grub. And given the size of a nematode and the size of a grub, to give you an image, that would be the equivalent of a human being attacked by 500 rabid budgies. You know, so the amount you're applying is a colossal amount, and it should really resolve the issue. You're not going to control every single grub in the soil, as I mentioned, but you would get it down to a acceptable level. And but if it's a serious infestation, then a second application would be prudent.
I'm just glad that I don't have to count the 500,000 into each pack. That must take that must take quite a while.
But it's 500 million in a pack.
Oh, 500 million. Oh, God, that'll take even longer. we've been asked here, what are your thoughts on applying nematodes with a wetting agent?
So first and foremost, you need to make sure that the wetting agent is compatible with nematodes. So some wetting agents are very hazardous to nematodes, can kill them. Other wetting agents are safe to use with nematodes. So you need to speak to your supplier, make sure that tests have been done, that they're confident, that they've proven that the wetting agent is compatible with the nematodes. So that's the first and foremost. Now I mentioned you want big droplets because you want you want to get your nematodes to the soil. So you want to use a wetting agent, you want to use a wetting agent that is going to do exactly that. It's not going to spread the droplets out on the leaf tissue. It's going to get the droplets through the turf canopy and to the soil. Where you do see wetting agents used in ornamental horticulture, for instance, so they have pests that are on the plant itself, on the leaf tissue, so they will use wetting agents that will make the water droplets spread over the leaf and will spread over the actual pest itself, because in that case you don't want a big water droplet that's just going to bounce off the leaf. You want that spreading ability. So yes, you can use wetting agents, but make sure they're compatible with nematodes, that they've been tested and proven to be compatible with nematodes, and that they're the type of wetting agent that gets the droplets down onto the base, onto the surface of the root zone, not spreading over the leaf tissue.
Okay, and we've got another question. Do EPNs negatively impact earthworms, which are a problem for quite a lot of people? Or as the name suggests, are EPNs restricted to insect larvae?
Yes, so they haven't been any, I'm not aware of them actually controlling earthworms, or if they do, it's certainly not to any great extent. So I would say that they are safe for worms. As I say, it's larvae and juvenile larvae that they are able to control. And I say that it's juvenile larvae because if we take Schaefer grubs, for instance, it's the first and second instar that they'll control. When a Schaefer grub gets to a third instar, it's better able to protect itself. So it doesn't release CO2 in one long stream. It will release it in bursts as it goes through the soil. And also it will shut down its anus, and it will close its mouth. So it's restricting the openings for nematodes to get into. And also they can actually clean themselves. They're they can wash off nematodes on their surface when they get to that latest, more mature stage. So that's why, most likely why they're not having a great impact on worms, is because it is newly hatched juvenile larvae and grubs that they're best able to control.
Okay. And finally, will any new chemicals be available soon?
Well, as you know, I work for Bayer. Bayer is a research and development company. We have a pipeline of development. Obviously, the control of turf pests is important to us. So, we are investigating it. But there is currently, or in the last couple of years, there's been a competitor product called Acelaprin that's been available under emergency use. Whether or not that will be available under emergency use anymore or in the future remains to be seen. But I think other than that, a new insecticide is a few years away, and it's quite likely, because of the changes in the regulatory requirements, all these different studies that have to be conducted and proven for the efficacy. So we have to show the minimum amount of active ingredient that achieves control and that kind of thing. So I think if a insecticide does become available in the future, it's probably not going to be as effective as the insecticides that we've had in the past, ultimately.
Okay, that's great. So I'd like to say thank you, Colin. That's been very interesting, I'm sure, for all the listeners. We would like to thank you for joining us, and we hope that you'll join us again soon. For details of future Continue to Learn Extra webinars, please visit the What's On page of the Bigger website. And we look forward to seeing you soon. Many thanks.
Thank you.
The Green Room Golf Course podcast is produced by myself, Carl Hansel, on behalf of the British and International Golf Greenkeepers Association. For questions, comments and concerns, you can get in touch with me by emailing carl@bigger.co.uk. That's Carl with a K. You can also join the conversation on social media using @greenroombigger. And we've also got a Facebook page where all the latest notices, news releases and information from Bigger can be found. We're also on Instagram using @bigger_HQ. Subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. The more people know about the sports turf industry, the more understanding they will have about the hard work of Bigger members and other greenkeepers. And speaking of Bigger membership, if you're inspired by what you hear to progress your career in greenkeeping, then a major first step is signing up to the association. The opportunities for career development are countless and potentially life-changing, such as volunteer opportunities at major tournaments and educational opportunities across Europe and the USA. Don't forget, if you're a golfer and you've got any questions about anything you hear on the podcast, have a conversation with the greenkeepers at your club. They've got the expertise to explain what's happening at the course and how it fits into the team's long-term vision to improve playability and enjoyment of the facility.